Careless on Flirt FM 101.3.
Hello and welcome to Wireless, a series all about radio, broadcast on the first Monday of every month on Flirt FM 101.3 in Galway and on flirtfm.ie. We're a week later than usual this month because of the holidays. I'm John Walsh and I'll be with you for the next hour. Wireless covers all aspects of radio, analogue and digital, community, regional and national broadcasters, pirate radio, podcasting, radio ownership and radio's history and future prospects. Coming up on the May edition of Wireless.
Your 24-hour community radio station.
Near FM.
We take a fascinating tour of the history of community radio in Ireland with Jack Byrne, founding member of the long-established community station Near FM in northeast Dublin. Who said that AM radio was dead? We hear from the Dublin pirate station Energy Power AM, which is back on air every weekend. And radio academic Andrew O'Beale tells us about the problem of US student and community radio stations losing their licences to public radio entities.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
But first to Radio Retro, which each month delves into the archives to unearth a gem from radio history. Over the last few months, we've featured some of the pirate radio stations of the 1980s, and we're staying in that decade again this month. While the country's best-known pirates were in Dublin, every city had its own stations, both community and commercial, and Galway was no exception. Coast 103 was one of the more commercially-minded stations of the 80s and was based right in the city centre on Air Square itself. It merged with a Limerick station which allowed it to be heard over a larger area of the West and Midwest. This recording is from November 1988, just a month before the station closed down, and features jingles and ads for a number of local businesses. See if you can work out how many of them are still in operation nearly 30 years later.
Broadcasting to the West and the Midwest 24 hours a day on AM and FM stereo, this is Coast Hot Hits.
All Hit Radio.
It's not simply a question of getting hot, but a matter of how much heat you can take.
Cork, Coast 100.5, Power FM. Martin Feeney Fashions, Upper Abbeygate Street, Galway, 8th anniversary celebration is now on. Specials include £20 of all suits and overcoats, £8 of all trousers, jeans and knitwear, £4 of all shirts. Many items are at half price and deposits will be taken on all goods. At the 8th anniversary celebration at Martin Feeney Fashions, 21 Upper Abbeygate Street, Galway.
A Gap sale is good to you. Better by now. Gap sale is good to you. Better believe it. Gap sale is good to you. Better bargain. Gap sale. It's the Gap sale.
The Gap sale. Now on at Beer Street, Galway.
There's all the fun of the fair at the Halloween Carnival at Ash Motors, Headford Road, Galway City, all this week. Tuesday the 1st, it's our fancy dress with over £100 in prizes. There's one free pass to every entrant as well. On Wednesday the 2nd, there's American Day. Ride all the fun fair rides as often as you like for just £2 between 3 p.m. and 6 p.m. and 7 p.m. and 10 p.m. Thursday the 3rd, it's our crazy night. There's all the fun of the fair at the Halloween Carnival at Ash Motors, Headford Road, Galway City, all this week.
Maximum power. Honest hits.
1966, that's the Hollies, and I can't let go. 28 minutes to 5 o'clock now.
Hi, students. Laffy's Bar. Welcome to Back to Galway. Laffy's in Mary Street, Galway, is now the traditional meeting place for students. Laffy's Bar has special promotions every Tuesday night during October, and you can see the latest and best videos every day. Good music, good crack, and good drink always guaranteed at Laffy's Bar. Come in and see us, and we'll get you into a fine mess. Laffy's Bar, Mary Street, Galway.
It's the Happy Spud in Lower Abbeygate Street, Galway. Everything, and I mean everything, on our menu is available to take away all day from 7:30 right through till 5:30, Monday through Saturday. And you won't have to wait. Just pick up the phone and call 62966. That's 62966. By the time you get there, your order's going to be packed and ready to go. I tell you, the Happy Spud in Lower Abigate Street makes eating real civilized. The Happy Spud.
Limerick, Tipperary, Kerry, Cork, Cove, 100.5 Power FM.
Some choice accents there on Coast 103 in Galway from November 1988. And that recording is courtesy of dxarchive.com. If you'd like to send us an archive recording for Radio Retro, get in touch through social media or on our blog, wirelessflirt.wordpress.com.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3.
Near FM is one of Ireland's best known and longest established community radio stations and has been broadcasting continuously from Coolock in northeast Dublin since 1995. Like many other stations, its previous incarnation was in the form of a pirate station in the late 1970s and 1980s. Near is run by a cooperative which consists of the radio station and Near TV, which makes programmes for broadcast on Dublin Community Television and online. Near FM broadcasts 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, and is run by a voluntary committee with the participation of over 150 volunteers and a small staff. The station is noteworthy for its commitment to the ethos of community broadcasting and acts as a strong voice for its community. Its website states that its aim is to provide an alternative to mainstream media, a voice for those underrepresented or excluded, through training and access to distribution facilities across all media platforms. I visited the station's studios in Dublin recently and met one of the founding members of Near FM, Jack Byrne, who's been involved in community radio in northeast Dublin for 40 years.
We had a pirate radio service quite close to this building here in Coolock. Well, it moved around the area. We had a pirate station called North Dublin Community Radio. And as I say, it went through about three or four different locations while we experimented. But yeah, it was quite a small... I had ideas about what it could do. Just briefly to sort of recap for you, in the sort of mid to the late 70s, there were a lot of young men in Dublin. FM transmitters were becoming available, so a lot of them were setting up small commercial radio stations, basically playing music and sending a few ads to local shops. I'm still not interested in the technology other than the social application of it, but it seemed to me, because I was involved with a lot of community projects, and there was always a problem in getting information out to people who maybe would participate or avail of the service, whatever service. I felt there was a good need for if we had a community radio station that would talk about community development issues. So we set up NDCR on that basis, that it would be predicated on the idea of using the tools of radio for community development. Now, we got a lot of young men, particularly with medallions and big boxes of discs and an attitude. We had to beat a lot of them away with a stick. We got too many of them, but we had enough. But it was still very much a music-driven station. I mean, the amount of talk, the amount of community development talk was like in comparison to the overall content. But that was the model of radio that particularly young men, young women maybe had more sense, they didn't seem to be as attractive, but young men definitely found radio allure and wanted to talk to the world and play their favourite music. So it was a basis for starting, but my concept always was that the music would be interspersed with a lot more critical theory content about what the type of society we live in, and a critique of it, and maybe suggestions of possibilities to improve things. So for me, it was always about possibility media, really.
And how did that go down with the young men and their medallions who came with their boxes of LPs and wanted to play their favourite music? Because to what extent were they tuned in with critical media theory about changing the society, or how did you educate people, I suppose, in that sense?
Well, they probably gave up eventually on most of them. But I think they beat me to it. They'd given up on me before that anyway. You know, we would have workshops and I would try to... I was even introducing media literacy. This was in about 1980. I was doing media literacy because I felt this was a really useful tool for critiquing and exploring media and how media plays with people's minds and the agendas of media. And I was reading Chomsky. I don't know anybody else was reading them, but They humoured me because basically I was finding the money to pay the bills and pay the rent and keep the place open so that they could indulge themselves. So to some extent they said he's an eccentric fool, but he's at least he's keeping the station on air. I always found some way to keep the thing on air. Plumaz, the landlord, if some of them had done something to annoy him in his building, I'd go and calm the thing down and we'd get another extension of time. So I think they appreciated my efforts in that sense and just sort of decided these are the Medallion Brigade. They just decided to write me off as an eccentric, you know. I don't think they knew quite what I was, you know.
But presumably your message was accepted by other people who came in behind you and who agreed with the philosophy of changing society through the media or of attempting to make people media literate and so on. So presumably you had support for that democratic kind of participative ethos.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I wouldn't be here, the project wouldn't be here other than some people came along and liked the sound of it and came back and asked me some more. We built up, I mean, I don't want to be too cynical, we built up quite a good cohort of people very early on. In the early 80s, we had a couple of good journalists liked the idea. They'd interviewed me and found that while they were getting excited with their notebook in over coffee and Bewley's, and I was explaining about this alternative media and the right to communicate and all this, and they said, this is brilliant stuff, wait till I write up my article. And I, from bitter experience, would caution, you may not get it past your sub-editor. Usually I'd get a phone call from the journalist and Barry say, they won't run with it, they won't print it, you know. So we were excluded. Instinctively, we were excluded. Offering alternative ways to do media didn't sit well with existing media. But some of those journalists liked what I was saying, and although they couldn't print it, they became involved. So they were important because they were bringing an intellect to it and a worldly sort of wisdom that I needed to surround myself with. So, yeah, very early on, I say by 1981, 82, there was a very good working group here who understood that. I think they understood the challenge of what we were trying to do, really, you know.
And what exactly inspired you? Can you tell us, just for the benefit of listeners, a little bit about the philosophy that inspired you back then in 1980, 1981, and that continues to inspire you today in terms of community radio as a tool for development? What exactly does that mean?
Well, I think initially I couldn't even articulate it. I think it just was a sort of an intuition, a sense that here was a technology. And I just happened to have in my company a couple of young men who were setting up little FM radio stations, and they were quite excited. And I saw how simple the technology was and how reasonably priced it was, and I realised this was within our grasp to have an actual radio station that we owned and the content that we could control. So I think it was really, I hadn't articulated, I think it's an odd thing to say, but I think I understood the essence of it before I understood the actual workings of it. I think I had just an intuition that this is something important, that if we use it in a certain way, it will be beneficial to our wider community. And having done that, I then had to backtrack and find out why I had this intuition. What did it actually mean? But I do think I just sensed an essence of what it would be. Now, I fleshed it out over the years by reading a lot and discussing it and travelling to mainly European countries where there's community radio and seeing how they do it. But all the bits fell into place. I mean, the initial essence was true. And I think I've just built a framework. I've sort of built a logic, I suppose, around it now, so that now I can, I suppose, explain it.
What's the logic then that you've worked out over the years? How would you explain that? Who inspired you? What thinkers have brought you to where your idea is today?
It's wide. Chomsky would be one. Habermas. These would be on the intellectual side. Well, Chomsky would be more the dissident voice. Habermas more the academic voice. But I've tried to incorporate, and I'm not an academic, but I've tried to understand even Habermas, and I mean, I'm reading Heidegger and Wittgenstein, and what I've tried to do is break their ideas and thoughts down to a level where I can absolutely clearly understand it, and I think then I have it at a level where I can present it to colleagues. You know, I sort of deconstruct Habermas or Wittgenstein and so on. So that's been a passion for me for the past 40 years anyway, and I'm still at it. I'm currently writing a long thesis, might be my last thesis, on media and human consciousness and human evolution. Like, I mean, I think the essence I sensed years ago, I'm still fleshing it out. I think I'm nearly there now with a theory of human consciousness and evolution and how communication fits into that, because I do think innately human beings are a sociable species. We like to communicate and we feel distraught if we're cut off from human communication. I think this is an innate characteristic, and I do think that the popularity of social media is a commercial service that is tapping into that need for humans to communicate. I think it's been exploited and misappropriated. Quite frankly, if you want to know, part of my thesis is that commercial media is a misuse of these important communications technologies. Particularly, I think, with climate change, we should be talking to each other across the planet about how we solve these big, big global issues. And I think commercial media is actually, and particularly social media, is getting in the way of a dispersed species talking to itself across the planet. You can see how much I've moved from trying to get an FM transmitter in Coolock 30 years ago.
And what does your theory or your logic mean today for a community like this in Coolock in northeast Dublin?
Well, a lot of it would be that we would do the programme, but we'd be more aware and more conscious and more focused on a communication between humans. And I think we've a lot of stuff to, I mean, here in Near FM we don't actually do the news, because we actually didn't want to just cut and paste news from maybe print newspapers or something, because that's the mindset of mainstream media that we're just propagating, and we're struggling at the moment and working through. It's sort of coming to fruition. I think we're going to develop citizen journalism as well, but we want to try and make sure that if citizens in northeast Dublin are going to feed data, information, facts into us, that they have a broader sense of what that could be also, how to deal with media, how to deal with information. And I worry about bias and objectivity, because I think these are just tools to suppress people's explaining themselves and being more intuitive and instinctive. I think we're subjective beings and we really can't be objective. I nearly lost our last license over this. I went in and spoke to Niall Stokes, who was giving us our license, and I argued with him because they were demanding that we would agree to be objective in our programming content, and I was arguing philosophically with him that, you know, we're objective beings and we're subjective beings and we can't really do this objectivity stuff. And of course I was being kicked under the table, don't annoy him till we get the bloody license, you know. So that was it. So that's the sort of thing I think we're developing. We also have the FELA in Clare at the end of May. This is the training festival that happens every year for CRAIL, the Community Radio Network. And with Tom McSweeney, the journalist, and myself, we're going to do a workshop on social benefit journalism. I got into the last Broadcasting Act in 2009. Well, Eamon Ryan was the minister, and I asked him to put into the Act an acknowledgement of the social benefit that community radio provided. But it didn't go in as an acknowledgement, it went in as a stipulation that community radio must provide a social benefit. So it wasn't quite where I'd hoped to place it, but it means that we welcomed it, but I just think it was in the wrong place. But I'm trying to now see, because there is talk now about a bursary maybe for journalism, which local radio will also tap into. But I want to see, can we use this opportunity now to develop a social benefit journalism? It'll take my idea, but I might be able to deposit it in a practical place where there's some money coming into a station if they can do a certain type of, so it won't be getting up in the morning and cutting the headlines out of the Irish Times and reading it back out to the listeners. It'll be a real, we need to reflect on it and think about it carefully, John. But I do think there's a model for, I just have an instinct that there's a model for community journalism that we haven't discovered yet or develop, but I think it's there. I'm absolutely sure it's there. We just need to spend a bit of time working on it.
So this is an alternative to the hourly news headlines on Today FM or even on 98 FM or whatever, a different type of hourly news service. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, it would be. I mean, I'm not even sure what it will sound like. I don't know whether it will start off with a jingle as usual, you know, here's the news. It may not do that. But I think at this stage, I have a sense that it's going to be possibilities news, okay? And I'll try and explain that. The idea would be that you don't depress people with news about even climate change and or a famine in some African country or another war somewhere in the Middle East, that someone sitting in their community in Ireland has no control over. What can they do about it? They just get depressed and there's an impotent rage, or they get, you know, just they feel apathetic because they know they can't do anything about it. So I think the first thing we can do, and I think it will be a real helpful service to listeners to news, if we can give them a possibilities format. Now, I haven't quite worked it out, but the idea I think would be that we'd present the news, the problem, either local or national or international, and part of the bulletin will talk about possibilities of how to solve it. Okay, so we'll offer possibilities so the listener isn't just left up in the air filled with impotent rage or apathy. There's possibilities to change, and we might even link that news bulletin to local organisations that deal with this particular topic. So if a person is animated by a news item, there may be something they can do about it. So I think that would be, I think it'd be quite a healthy, healing form of news that, and it wouldn't be patronising or not dealing with the hard issues. I think it actually, the challenge will be to absolutely deal with the hard issues, but to find a different way of dealing with them, and encouraging every listener to participate in some form that suits them. So that's the sort of model I'm inching towards with possibility news.
So it's a form of empowering people, I suppose, which is what community radio is supposed to be about in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this would, that's what I'm saying. I think at the moment news disempowers totally. I feel the same myself when I listen to the news bulletins. I mean, I'm engaged with this, with the situation, but I don't know how to solve it as an individual. So I think our news has to be a healthier form of news. It has to be richer, and it has to show people that there are ways for you, if you're engaged, you can be animated and you can do something about it. So I think it'll be healthier for people's psyche as well if they have a news bulletin that doesn't just leave them sitting there fuming.
Can I go back to the period of NDCR and the, of course, NDCR, like all other stations, had to go off the air at the end of 1988. And then there was a hiatus before Near FM was licensed. Yeah. So what were the people who had been involved with NDCR, yourself and colleagues, what were you doing in those intervening years to keep the keep the spirit of community radio alive when you couldn't actually broadcast?
Well, that was I think at that stage we were lucky that we had sort of coalesced a group of people who liked the idea. The DJs wandered off, took their medallions and their boxes of records, and they found maybe there were still one or two pirate radio stations on. So they were never going to stay with us because they didn't ever understand what we were doing. If they're out there today, good luck. I hope you're all doing well, and hope your medallions haven't rusted. But there was a small cohort that liked what we were doing, and we met. We had a monthly meeting with a committee of management that met in embryo with no radio station, no prospect. I mean, Ray Burke at the time was the minister, and he assured me that, because I was chair of the NACB, which was the before CRAIL, was the original organisation. We met with him, and he assured me that he just wanted to get the commercial radio, local radio, on air first and give them a little bit of time to bed down, and then he would turn his attention to community radio. And of course, as we know, it was never going to happen. And it took Michael D. Higgins as Minister for Communications, and as I say, I acknowledge him anytime I'm talking about it to people. I didn't even have to explain community radio to Michael D. He understood it instinctively. He understood it. It was great to meet a politician who absolutely had enough intelligence and integrity to understand this model of media that none of the others. I'd talked about half a dozen ministers before that who scratched their heads and what is he on about. So Michael D. was great, and as I said, it sort of broke the logjam, and then we got the pilots in 95. But in the interim, we had quite a few years of nothing to do, so we just held workshops. But we met monthly. We were very formal. We had minutes, and we met monthly, and we planned, and we did fundraising, and we would do sort of publicity activities to keep the idea alive in the area. So we kept active, but it wasn't easy to keep the enthusiasm and the momentum going when there was no sign at all for several years that we were ever going to get licences. It looked pretty bad at one stage. But we kept going because I think the group I had with me at that stage had grasped the idea and felt it was worth pursuing, and I think that just kept us going.
And when did Near FM then, as we know it today, when did it begin to broadcast? Well, first of all, I suppose there was a pilot stage, wasn't there?
That's right. When we finally got the go-ahead, I mean, it was the IRTC at the time, or the BCI, I think it was called. They decided they would run a pilot service just to try. So some of the more active community pirates applied. So there was Kilkenny and ourselves, Connemara. There was about four or five stations in Dublin, one in Finglas that collapsed very quickly. But the five stations set up anyway to pilot what community radio, because again, the authority hadn't a clue, didn't know what it was. They didn't actually know what this animal was at all that we were proposing to them. That, but so we ran it, and as I say, it worked quite well. I mean, we didn't cause upheavals and revolutions. It was quite mild. I often remember when I went in to see the first, well, I was actually the first person in to see the IRTC when it formed, and they were asking me, they were all frowning at me, what would community radio be? They couldn't figure, and I was it safe radio? I talked about the Boy Scouts and the Girl Guides when they went off for a weekend, and when they came back, so they could go on air and talk about, and I don't know whether it sounded even more obscure to them, but I thought that must be safe radio. You know, I wasn't saying we'd have Trotsky seminars or anything. So, but that was it. We got on air anyway, and we ran it, and as I say, only one collapse. So at the end of the pilot period, I think it was 18 months pilot period, they were satisfied. One, we weren't totally troublemakers, and two, it just seemed to be a smaller version of local radio. And I do have to say that at one stage, while I was aggrieved with Ray Bourque, because a lot of the stations that were in the NACB and the model of community radio that we were talking about wasn't my model. Mine was still my essence that was bubbling away somewhere, my subconscious. Most of them were talking about what has emerged finally as local radio. So there's a news bulletin, the drive time, interviews, some music, sell a few ads. And I was actually happy in a way. It's amazing how you can sort of assuage your anger by time. I knew the Bell Ray had shafted us, but I said, that's okay. So local radio has now sort of stolen our clothes, you know. So we need to go back to the drawing board. I said to this group, we have to find a different model if we're going to justify getting on air. We can't just say we'll do local radio light. We have to be. So they were all scratching their heads because this was their model. So it gave me an opportunity, a bit of a chink, to start talking about other alternative. What could we do that's different to local radio? So to that extent, I was happy that when we got the licences, certainly here, my group had spent several years exploring alternative ways to do radio. Some of it, as I say, has come through. I'd like more of it here, quite frankly, in there. But in general, we're quite a progressive station. I mean, we've good connections and links to progressive community media across the planet and across Europe. So we were ready with a programming format when we got going. So, and I think we've developed it since. I mean, it's never going to satisfy me. I'm just one of those mavericks that wants more and more of the same thing. It probably is as well that there's people here with a bit more sort of balance, because maybe by the time, if I was totally in control of programming, it might not be really listenable to, really. And I accept that. So I tend to accept that there's need for music, and we do a lot of community news and current affairs stuff, and we cover a lot of local organisations and give them a voice. So it's a good model, but I think there's still a little bit more tweaking that could be done to take it to the next level. So I'm still hoping to get it to the next level. So watch this space.
Jack Byrne, one of the founding members of Near FM in northeast Dublin, and also chair of CRAIL, the Community Radio Forum of Ireland. You can listen to Near on 90.3 FM in Dublin or online at nearfm.ie. Jack mentioned that the CRAIL FEILA, the annual meeting of the community radio sector, will take place at the end of this month in Ennistymon in County Clare. We'll be at FEILA and we'll bring you voices from the festival in next month's programme.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
The vast majority of car and kitchen radios still have an AM band, but this option has been declining in popularity in recent years, and several of the national European broadcasters have switched off their AM transmitters in favour of FM or DAB.
AM is still used extensively in many countries, such as the UK, Spain and the US, but the trend is towards a migration away, at least of larger broadcasters, leaving AM to pirates and smaller community stations. AM consists of medium wave, long wave and short wave, and was the earliest method used to transmit voice by radio. In Ireland, it has been largely ignored since the emergence of legalised commercial and community radio in the 1990s. As reported before on this programme, RTE's longwave transmitter has long been threatened with closure, and there are only a handful of stations in the Republic of Ireland broadcasting on medium wave, most of them pirates. AM has lower audio quality than FM, but signals can travel much further, particularly at night, although they are prone to interference during the hours of darkness. It's unusual for a new AM operator to appear, so we sat up and took notice when we heard that the pirate station Energy Power AM was back on air in Dublin on 1395 kHz every weekend. I headed to Dublin to find out more and met Paul, one of the people behind the station.
My background in radio started around 1979, 1980, when I first heard the AM pirates here in Dublin, of which there was about three or four. And I just got the bug for radio, and listening to music on the good old AM radio just was something new. And I thought it was really good at the time, from the Radio Luxembourg days even, or Radio Caroline from the 80s as well. So I always had this affinity to listening to AM radio and get involved with AM radio.
And you were involved in other stations then in the 80s and 90s as well, weren't you?
I was indeed. I was involved with DLR, which started off in Dunleary on AM back in 1980 on 963 on the medium wave, 312 metres. And we ran that for about three or four years on AM, and then the guys went their separate ways and grew up, as they say. And things went off there around mid-80s, 85, 86. But then in the 1990s, a group of us got back together again and started DLR from Dunleary, which was very popular on FM from 1991 to 2000. And they weren't on AM at all in those days, but it was a very popular FM station in Dunleary, probably one of the fewer bigger pirates in the 90s in Dunleary itself, John.
And tell us about the background to Energy Power AM then. Obviously, it's a bit unusual having anybody on AM these days. It's very much the forgotten part of the radio spectrum, I think. So what's the background to the station, and how long have you been broadcasting for?
Well, John, we've been broadcasting since about 2005 on AM. We did test transmissions around 2005. And we built the first solid-state AM transmitter, which in itself is quite unique, because in the old days it was all big high-powered valves, glass valves, and dangerous stuff with high voltage and that. But it's all solid-state transmitter, and it's been modified and uprated over the years. And we've just about got it sounding as good as we're going to get it sounding now. But at the moment, it's sounding pretty well at the moment. But we hope to get a studio set up very shortly, a proper full-time studio, which we haven't got set up yet. It's basically only on test at the moment. And in the coming months, maybe in a month or two, we hope to have a studio and have some really good live programming each and every weekend on the station.
So the idea is to have a weekend station then. And what kind of programming, or what will be the focus of programming?
Well, the programming will be mainly music from the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s and 90s, and all types of music in those particular decades. Where we feel FM radio, even today with the oldie stations, they don't seem to concentrate as much on the music pre-1979, say. So we hope to be really playing a lot more of the 60s, 50s, 60s, 70s music that we think has been left out totally. And this was the music that was played on AM back in the old days anyway, so it's finding its home back on the old AM band, which has been really lost, I think, since 1989. I don't know why they didn't license stations on AM since 1989, because in Dublin especially, the FM spectrum now is full. I would say there's hardly any positions on the FM band for anybody to go on FM, but on AM there's plenty of free channels that could be used on AM for broadcasting, I think, at the moment, you know.
Why do you think AM was abandoned entirely 25 years ago? Why was this decision made, do you think?
I don't know why it was made, really, to be honest with you, because we all know that FM sounds better, and there's no denying the FM sound quality is better. But in some areas, especially with small stations, FM is very limited to, you know, height. Like, it's okay if you have a transmitter on the top of a mountain, you will cover vast areas. But especially for community stations, it's if they're in, you know, mountain terrain at all, the signal is blocked very easy, whereas AM can penetrate mountainous areas a little bit better than FM. But as I said, AM, it's it's got its own little niche and its own sort of sound, and I still think they could, community or small stations could make a go of it, especially with oldies or even talk-based music stations or sports-based stations. In the States, it's still very, very popular, AM. It hasn't lost its popularity in the States, especially for talk radio and sports radio, you know.
What is it about the AM sound that you like? As you said, it's not as high quality as FM, but it seems to have its own attraction for some people.
Well, if you listen, actually, it's funny you should say that, because I was listening on an old radiogram in a person's house to Energy about 5 years ago, and I saw this radiogram in the house, a big old Pi radiogram, and I turned it on and was listening to the AM sound, and it just has that warm sort of sound. It's not very shrilling. It's just got that warm sound, that AM sound, I think, that it's nice to listen to, especially when if you have a good signal, like, I know, but really, if the signals are weak, it's not really very, to listen to music, it's not very, very good. But within strong signal areas, it can still sound good with a good radio, you know.
And what about your own technical setup for Energy then? How would you describe that in general terms for a lay listener?
Well, technically wise, it's running, audio-wise, we think we have it nearly as good as it's going to sound for AM, which will be as good as what Radio Nova sounded back in the AM days in the 1980s with the same sort of audio processing equipment that they were using. We're using identical audio processing equipment. Given that, of course, we're not running the same sort of power levels they were running. We're running my new power levels. But given that, for the antenna system that's there and the signal is pretty good for what the power level we're running, I think we're covering a good 10-mile radius from the transmitter, I would say.
And you've received reception reports from abroad as well, haven't you?
Yeah, well, at night time, the added bonus of AM signals is that they bounce off the ionosphere and you can get some skywave reception. And we've had reports from the UK and even as far as Sweden at night time from ham radio enthusiasts who would have very good receivers and antennas to receive it. But generally speaking, it's a 10-mile coverage area, really, of ground wave signal during the day. And that's about as good as we're going to get. And we're happy enough with that radius and signal for the moment.
And obviously you're doing this on a part-time basis as a hobby almost. But on a more serious note, there is a gap there in the market in terms of the music that you're trying to play. So that's very much a comment, I suppose, on the state of radio today in Dublin and in Ireland.
Well, indeed, John, that's what I said. Like the oldies stations in Dublin and FM, they're very limited in the music they play, and oldies, and I would say the playlists are very, very, probably maybe 300 or 400 songs is their max playlist of oldies that they keep on repetition, whereas we hope to have the guts of 10,000 songs on our playlist from oldies from the 50s upwards. So there will be a good variety of music on our station every weekend. So if you want to hear really good oldies from the 50s and 60s and 70s that you don't hear played on FM radio in Dublin especially, well, we hope you'll find them on the old medium wave on 1395 and Energy Power AM.
And what would you say to people who would say that AM's days are over and that nobody's really listening anymore, particularly in Ireland, given that there's been such a poor tradition of AM in the last 30 years now?
Well, the younger audience, I would say yes. I mean, I think the only type of people that will listen to AM sort of radio are an older generation, I would think. I would find myself now listening to AM radio at night. I would either listen to BBC Radio 5 Live, if there's something interesting on that, or indeed BBC Radio 4 on 198 on Longwave, which is AM as well, of course. And, of course, at the weekends, 1368 Manx Radio from the Isle of Man has some great AM programming. And if you want to listen to good AM radio sound quality, they really have it. And I think they have a good selection of music as well. And they do a great oldies program on a Saturday morning, a Radio Caroline type program on Manx Radio, which is, they're really keen on keeping the AM thing going alive in the Isle of Man as well, and they have it really sounding well. So I still think there is a little bit of a niche left for the old AM.
Paul of Dublin Pirate Station Energy Power AM on 1395 kilohertz. There's no doubt that AM has a very distinctive sound and is very reminiscent of radio during its golden years, and here's hoping that predictions of its demise are premature.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
And finally to the US, where many college radio stations find themselves facing the challenge of losing their licenses as their host universities sell off the FM channels to public radio stations. WUMD at the University of Maryland are in the midst of fighting to retain their license, and some of the major alternative or indie college-based stations in San Francisco and Texas have encountered similar issues. This has sparked a lot of college radio activism, including the annual College Radio Day. NUI Galway lecturer in humanities Dr. Andrew O'Buil is an expert on community radio and a former manager of Flirt FM. I asked him to explain the challenges facing college radio in the US.
Well, one of the things that we've seen quite an uptick of in the last number of years has been some fairly established, long-term established college radio stations, ones that are have lots of support among their student populations, who do a lot of outreach into communities that are well respected and well established, losing their broadcast channels, and not losing it through any particular mistakes or errors on their part. What's been happening is that various universities have been surrendering their licenses, surrendering their broadcast licenses, and doing it by way of swapping the licenses, giving them to other public radio and non-commercial outlets. This, in my view, is part of a pullback by various universities that had been willing to at least tacitly accept, if not give overwhelming support to the sort of community outreach and a broader, expansive vision of what how a university might engage with its community, and in recent times they've decided to pull back, to a little bit of retrenchment in terms of their mission, and also short-term financial gains. While non-commercial broadcast licenses here in Ireland, if you're given a license, if you're granted a contract with the BAI, if there's any change in ownership, that's something that needs to be negotiated with the BAI and agreed to by the BAI. In the US, if you have a commercial station, you can just sell that on to anybody. So if you had the equivalent of a Galway Bay or a News Talk, sell it on. There are some controls sometimes in terms of cross ownership, whether or not somebody has a radio station and a TV station in the same market. But otherwise, you sell it on to anybody. There are restrictions for many university stations because they are in a protected part of the band from 88 megahertz up to 92, which is reserved for non-commercial outlets. So you can't just sell on your license. But what you can do is you can assign it to another non-commercial entity that will run non-commercial content on it, and they can reimburse you certain expenses and certain funds in return for that. So universities are seeing this sometimes as a way to get short-term financial benefits, to engage, to replace having a broadcast channel, which is used by perhaps a student-run group, with a chunk of change coming into the central university coffers, and also perhaps some sort of guarantee of work placements or some sort of
a SOP.
A SOP is how many of the students see it. You can get studio experience in this other station, but you don't get to
but you
station.
Lose your own station.
Exactly.
But is this not a sale in anything but everything but name then?
Yes, and it's a sale. There are brokers, Public Radio Capital, and a small number of other entities are making their business model around facilitating the introductions, getting their cut off the consideration that's being made for these. So, you're talking large sums of money. You're talking. The license going from the person who gives the money, or from the person who gets the money to the person who gives the money. So it's a sale. There are restraints on how much you can get in terms of actual cash value. But that's largely what, if you're the person running the station, if you're the people working in the station, your channel has been sold out from under you.
So are the non-commercial stations taking over these community stations or these campus stations are essentially affiliates of National Public Radio then? Is that the case?
They are. Now, the model in the US is perhaps something that Irish audiences may not be familiar with, which is National Public Radio in the US is a is essentially a content originator based out of DC. They run NPR News. They run a number of other programs, All Things Considered, and so on. But they do not run. They do not own broadcast outlets. NPR affiliates are largely non-commercial entities that have broadcast licenses and then contract with NPR to provide the content for that. And so you've got some of the large ones, Minnesota Public Radio, you've got Illinois Public Media at the University of Illinois. You've got these relatively local, but in Irish terms, you know, larger than our state broadcasters here in terms of, you know, reach and so on. But these local or regional affiliates that own the stations and feed the content to it. There has been. Since the 1980s, there's been a lot of consolidation, a lot of attention, particularly to consolidation in commercial radio in the US. Until 1980 or so, you could only own seven FM channels in the US. There's about 15,000 radio stations in the US. So you could have just a very small number. Over time, those caps got raised, those caps got removed, other than the cross-ownership limitations. And so a lot of attention went to the growth of really large networks like Clear Channel, which ended up owning 800 or 1,000 of those radio stations. On the non-commercial end, though, what you've also seen is that some of the larger non-commercial NPR affiliates have been consolidating. They have been looking to generate scale, and also have been looking to get hold of additional channels that they haven't had access to. In a lot of the U.S., there's a shortage of channel space. The way that the FCC has licensed radios has generally privileged larger outlets. They will look for, you know, a 30,000 or 100,000 watt station to cover a large area, rather than looking for smaller individual stations. And so when you license larger geographic areas, you very quickly run out of space. And so places like New York, like Chicago, it's very difficult to get hold of channels, and even in many of the suburbs of these large cities, unless you take it from somebody who previously has a license.
And the victims in this case is the low power community radio sector.
Well, in sometimes low power, sometimes stations. You look at something like KUSF, the radio station of the University of San Francisco, which is a private university in San Francisco. And they had a full power license, which they'd had for several decades. So these are, you know, universities have been around for quite some time. The growth in FM licenses in the US was in the mid 1970s through to the 1980s. So there was, you could see retrospectively, you can see it as something of a land grab. If you were a university that had an active group, that had somebody looking to get a channel at that stage, it was possible to get a full power license to secure the funding and to get going. Now, of course, you're there with, you know, relatively large acreage, so to speak, but now there's bigger players. State size public outlets that are looking to, in the case of, say, some of the California outlets, are looking to have an additional separate network so that they don't have to have channel sharing by their news outlet and their classical music outlet. They can have, you know, here's NPR News, here's NPR Classical on two separate sets of frequencies around the Bay Area. And so KUSF lose out on this because they're there doing their college radio, alternative radio stuff, very, you know, well respected, a good reputation. Why I mentioned them in particular is there was a lot of activism on foot of their loss of their license, with a lot of bands and musicians who said, well, we were broken by this. This is a place that's important to pop, well, not pop culture, but you know, subcultures and alternative cultures in the city, and is part of the landscape of innovative music there. And so, but that's not as big budget. That's not as established as something like a classical music station, which is, you know, which is a minority interest, but tends to be one that is more a well-heeled minority interest. And so we see this kind of larger sums of money, larger entities essentially looking to build networks. KUSF, they just had their one channel. They weren't interested in empire building and in buying up other areas around the bay in order to have kind of a network of indie music outlets. Maybe that should have been something that they would consider, but it's something that they were just happy doing their thing. You get the larger outlets are looking to find available frequencies that they might be able to amalgamate into their operations.
So what are they doing now then, KUSF?
KUSF, initially they were online. They have just recently, I think they've secured a low power FM station.
So they've gone back considerably from their high-power operation, having been sold out from under them, and then they're back at a very low-power operation again.
Yeah, and low-power stations in the US, you know, specifically these are around 100-watt operations. So you're on air, 100 watts, you'll get maybe 3 miles, maybe 5 miles in terms of your radius. So you can get the area immediately around your campus. But if you're looking to, in a city like San Francisco, which is of course also a very hilly city, so there's going to be a lot of obstacles to securing to getting to various neighborhoods and so on, and so you're you know, that's taken into account in terms of if you put your antenna up high, the power output you're allowed drops in order to make sure that you don't go beyond that 3-5 mile radius. So you're looking at stations that are now on air. They're more than toy operations, but as you say, they're very much reduced in terms of their reach, their ability to reach, say, teenagers in the San Francisco suburbs for whom you know, this is their first foray into the various alternative cultures of the San Francisco area.
And what is the solution to all of this? Because obviously this is a serious threat to the viability of community radio and campus radio, perhaps even more starkly into the future, because this mechanism of transferring the licenses is a result of a loophole, you said.
Yeah, it's, you know, a loophole implies that it's unintentional. The FCC is, as a licensing authority, in many respects far more hands-off than the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland is here in Ireland. Here in Ireland, your schedule needs approval, your membership of your board needs to be, you know, you need to keep the BAI up informed. If you change ownership, that needs to be approved by the BAI. The FCC, largely, you need to keep your paperwork up to date so that they know things, but they don't engage in deciding who, you know, once you get a license, and there it's kind of it's a point scoring system that avoids some of the more qualitative decisions that have historically been made here in Ireland, and so the idea is to allow essentially market mechanisms, even if they're non-commercial market mechanisms, to make those determinations. So it's a feature of the system that licenses can be transferred over to the entity that is now best situated to run it. And I was involved with a community radio station when I was based in the US. I was involved with a number of stations. I was involved with a radio station in Urbana, Illinois. We had secured, or the group I was involved with had secured one of the first low-power FM stations when they were licensed in the early thousands. And it was the Socialist Forum of Urbana-Champaign secured the license. It was able to do so because it was a long-established local community organization. Points were given in the application process for organizations that were long established in their communities and could demonstrate that. But the Socialist Forum is as the name might imply, it's a group of socialist activists who are interested in socialism and political activism. Not necessarily, or not primarily, media practitioners, media activists. Before the station came on air, there had been established a local independent media centre, part of an informal dispersed network of independent media centres around the US and later around the world. It did not have the it did not it was not long enough established to be a good candidate to get an LPFM license. But they make media, and so the Socialist Forum assigned its license over to the IMC. Because it was a better fit for Socialist Forum to get out of the business of running radio stations and hand that over to an entity that was structured in the totality of its organization around making media, making independent and alternative media. And so there you see that this is how the assignment process is meant to work. Because of the overlap in membership, because of the way that the organization had worked, there wasn't any pressure or need for much of a consideration or any consideration to go from one organization to the other. These are, grassroots organizations that were essentially swallowing the cost of running the station and of taking it over. But sometimes you'll get someone who will take over a studio that somebody has, and it makes some sense that you would be able to say, well, we're taking the studio you've invested in, here's the depreciated cost of that studio. But what we're seeing in the university system, in the university case, is that largely the student organizations have been, it's particularly stations that are integrated into student life rather than into course life. So you get, here in Ireland, one of the first community radio stations based in a college was the Dublin Weekend Radio run out of DCU. It was relatively short run, but that was a station that was largely a project of the School of Communications at Dublin City University. The idea was it integrated into modules. It was very closely part of the school operations. Those sorts of stations are much better protected institutionally when it comes to the US, because you've got people who say, well, I can't run my class if you do this. This is something that's part of our USP for our unique selling point for our degree. The stations that are finding themselves in trouble are those that are more grassroots student operations, a little more like perhaps you might think of Flirt FM here on campus, which is largely run by student volunteers and student activists with some paid staff funded by student contributions, but if you look at the here in Ireland, the license is held by a specific company owned by the university on behalf of the student body. But it is the university that has the shares in that, the majority of shares in that company. If we were in the US, the NUIG would very easily be able to say, well, that's a student thing. Do we really? What benefit is it to, say, the journalism programs that I run? Would it make more sense for us to get RTE to give us some studio time, get RTE to give us a number of workshops a year in return for us giving our frequency away to them? And so that's largely what you're seeing is universities saying, well, we got this license a long time ago. It's those students who are running it, but no one on academic council, no one inside the rooms where these decisions are made have thought about this station in years. They want to listen to the classical music station, and so you're seeing there kind of a disconnect between the people who have the signing power over these stations, the budgetary power over the stations, and who actually is engaged with it, who sees it as something valuable and part of their cultural experience.
Andrew O'Beale of NUI Galway. And that brings us to the end of this month's edition of Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. We'll be back on the first Monday in June with more news from the radio world, including a feature on the Craol Féile, the annual meeting of the community radio sector, which will be held at the end of this month. I do hope you'll join us then, but in the meantime, you can follow us on Twitter @WirelessFlirt and on Facebook.com/
wirelessflirt. There's also a blog accompanying the programme, wirelessflirt.wordpress.com. Until the next edition of Wireless, this is John Walsh wishing you good listening.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3.